Hello and welcome to an episode of Mere Fidelity. I'm Andrew Wilson. I'm hosting today. I don't know how that's been allowed to happen. I'm here with Derek Rishmawi and Alistair Roberts and a very exciting special guest, Chris Arnardi, whose new book, Dignity, has literally just been released in the last few days. Chris is a remarkably sort of polymathic individual. He has a PhD in particle physics, has been a bond trader, and is more recently a photojournalist who has traveled the length and breadth of the U.S. Photographing, documenting, and writing about poverty, and doing it in, to my mind, a very compelling way, and created a beautifully produced as well as very well-written book, which is quite soul-searching and challenging and at times quite visceral and hard to read, but also quite hopeful and quite honest. And yeah, I mean, I don't want to take all of the fire out of it before we've even started talking to him. But it's great to have you on the show, Chris. Thank you so much for being with us. It is a real privilege you give us your time. I saw you interviewed on some high-powered TV station the other day, so I thought, wow, what's he doing with us, which is really great. So thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. I much prefer doing these things than to high-powered TV.
Yeah. I mean, this is the very generic, boring question, after which we'll get to more interesting matters, I suppose. But it would be helpful for those who have not yet read the book, which I guess many won't have because it's only just come out. Can you just set up for us how you ended up writing it? It's a good story. So how is it that you came to write a book on this subject? And obviously it's pretty unusual to have a book which is both full of photographs as well as full of prose. And how is it you came to do both of those things together and write this particular kind of book?
You know, that's the question I get asked all the time that I just don't really have a good answer for, unfortunately. I mean, I can say the financial crisis caused me to rethink the way I thought about things. But it was a longer process than that. I mean, I, as you mentioned, I have a PhD in physics. And all my life I've been somebody who is very focused on the rational, focused on data, focused on what I call, not theologically, but philosophically, positivism. I always saw things in the framework of kind of what was their utility and how to think about that, without really knowing that's what I was doing, but that's what I was doing. And over my life, I started drifting more and more and starting to think whether that way of thinking and that way of experiencing the world, where at some point for 20 years of my life, I was literally sitting in front of a wall of computers flashing numbers and making bets on those numbers and thinking within the framework of those numbers was the way, that sort of process was the best way to see the world or to understand the world. And all my life, the way I kind of also kind of release stress, or what I did for a hobby, was to take these extraordinarily long walks. I think that's more of a thing they do in England, but they don't do much here in the United States. Where I'd walk 20 miles.
we definitely do it here. I've experienced it doesn't happen as much in the States.
I would walk 20 miles. So when I was living in New York City, the very first day I arrived there, I walked. I took the subway to the terminus, to the end, and at the Cloisters Museum, and walked the entire length of Broadway down back to Brooklyn. And that was my way of kind of like dealing with, just kind of using it to see things outside of the data. And those walks started to evolve as I got more experience in Wall Street and became more disillusioned with my job. I started using them to, at some point I brought along a camera, and I realized that in the process of taking pictures of people, they would open up to me and they would tell me all these stories about their life or invite me to go into their home and have a meal. And that sort of process of learning by the qualitative instead of the quantitative of actually dealing with people at an individual level kind of became more and more the way I saw the world. And I began to realize more and more that the other way I had seen the world through this utilitarian framework of just numbers was very limited, and that I wasn't the only one who did this, that most of what I would call the front row, but now I call it better thought of as kind of our political elites, our intellectual elites, all kind of have this framework of looking at things only in terms of numbers and data and making policy based on that and not understanding the consequences of their actions because they don't really physically see or hear about the consequences of their actions. So to put it in the language of a mathematician, I went to Hunts Point, which or South Bronx, which is the poorest neighborhood within New York City. It statistically has all the problems. It's the leader in all the problems. It's the most crime, poorest neighborhood. What I found was, so I guess to understand the world, I went to the boundary. I went to where things are considered the worst, and to understand the consequences of the actions of the elites. What I found there was so much different than, you know, the data would say I would find. The data would say I would find a dysfunctional neighborhood that was bereft of any humanity, when in fact it was statistically dysfunctional, but very functional at a personal level and community level, where there was a lot of community there, a lot of community formed out of ad hoc institutions by necessity, a lot of beauty there, a lot of welcomeness there, a very welcoming neighborhood.
I had a question. I wanted you to unpack a bit the front row versus the back row. Now you're saying elites, and so just for our readers who haven't heard this, this was a very useful heuristic, interpretive grid for me as I was reading along. I recognized a lot of the portrait. So if you want to just unpack that a little bit for them to, and then kind of fill out some of what you, in a sense. It seems like you wrote this book for the front row, and kind of like why you saw the need for that. So maybe unpack that, the concept, and then kind of why you were aiming at them a bit.
Right. So after I went to the Bronx, I kind of went on the road, and I put 160,000 miles on my car, 150,000 miles on my car, going to other, quote, stigmatized neighborhoods. And what struck me, in contrast to where I had worked for the last 20 years in New York City, the neighborhoods I lived in, you know, we talk about so many divisions these days. We talk about wealth, we talk about race, but what struck me was that kind of the more salient division, at least in terms of how we think about the world, in terms of our worldview, was education. You know, those other bond traders around me, the political elites who I supported, I likened to the front row. They were kind of the kids in class who always were eager to raise their hand, always sat at the front, always wanted the teacher to know that they knew, and followed this path that, although the members of it were remarkably diverse, that path wasn't diverse. It weaved through a certain set of institutions and that were all very familiar in the U.S., Harvard, Princeton. And then going to grad school, maybe Harvard Law or Penn. And the places I was spending my time all across the country, which are racially diverse, were united in the sense that most of the residents didn't have an education that went beyond high school. And if it included college, it was generally a community college or a trade school. And I started realizing, as I spent more and more time, I almost say that it took a while to learn that both groups, the front row and the back row being the people who don't have that intense education, generally speak a different language. I mean, we both speak English, but the way we frame things and the way we think about things is so fundamentally different that it took me almost 3 years of spending time in the back row, which is where I had grown up, to reconnect and realize that, you know, we just don't see eye to eye. I mean, it was just fundamentally different.
What do you think are the couple of most fundamental divides? I noticed a couple that you highlighted in the book in terms of place and meaning, in a sense, how meaning is constructed and how place figures into that. But if you had to kind of narrow down and say the couple of main determinants between kind of the front row worldview and the way what folks experience in the back row, what would you...
I call it kind of, I think it comes down to what I call credentialed forms of meaning. The front row kind of really only thinks in terms of credentialed resumes, you know. It's only really I think everybody wants to be a larger part of something, be a valued member of something larger than themselves. And in the front row, they find that through their resume. That's how they fit in. That's how they define themselves through their career. And it's a very quantitative I don't want to keep going back to this, but it's central, I think, is the secular versus non-secular. It's very much a utilitarian positivism-based idea that it really is about your usefulness in a material sense. Like, how much money can you make? How much more efficient can you make your company? How many degrees you have from credential schools that will allow you into this neighborhood and this institution to be part of this kind of like global migratory class who is as comfortable and as comfortable in Soho, New York as they are in Chelsea, London, and that kind of, it's a very material based, but in a very, very transactional based worldview. Whereas in the back row, it's the forms of meaning by almost necessity are non-credentialed. You don't have access to credentials. So it's a wonderful way to deal with poverty is that you take, you find value in things that can't, that you are gifted by birth. Things like identity, things like place, and things like faith that, I'm loath to say this as a theologian because you'll probably think, I'm probably wrong on this, but in many, many cases, the churches I saw did not require credentials to enter. That they really had low barriers to entry. And so it allowed you to be a member of something larger than a valued member of something larger than yourself without having a long resume. It's for things that were just gifted to you. And I think the front row has devalued those forms of meaning, which is a problem.
I'd be interested to hear you unpack a bit more the metaphor of front and back row. A couple of things that occurred to me when you were speaking about it. First of all, that the metaphor almost presumes that these two parties are within the same room, whereas often what I think we maybe see and what you describe is a situation where the front row has been removed from the room and now exists in a different realm entirely and is disconnected from the lives of those on the back row, whereas previously they may have been the pillars within those particular communities. Now they're a globalized class and they're no longer connected with or concerned with or exposed to the lives of those on the back row. The other thing that I was interested in hearing your thoughts upon was the relationship between people that you describe on the back row, but maybe we could distinguish between different back rows. So the person who works in McDonald's versus the homeless person who goes to McDonald's in a deprived community, or maybe the small shopkeeper and how their outlook on life would differ from someone else within their community who is in a different state of life. How do we understand the differences between the generations, for instance, in these contexts? Just unpacking maybe a further differentiations within the back row.
To your first point, I think it's probably the largest change in my lifetime. I'm 54. And I grew up in a small southern town, a back row community, but we had wealthy people there, and we all interacted. We all did that. We all, by necessity, we all went to the same school, as you said, the same classroom. I sat in the front, but the reality was, we mingled a lot because that's just what you did. And that was kind of out of necessity. There was one school, one park, one football team, all those things. And the very wealthy and the people in the community, the ones who owned the families who were part owners in the factory. There was one factory in town, who part owners of the factory. While they had a nice house, their kids still went to the schools. We still play football with the kids and all those things. That's changed over my lifetime. Now there's a real bifurcation where, as you said, they're not even the same schools anymore. And that's a problem. I think I went, there were places I've gone in these communities that have been suffering where the kids who are smart, the front row kids, are literally quarantined and pulled away and put into these special schools, and they'll never come back. They will all leave their community and never come back. And I can't fault them for that. I did that, but it's just not the way it used to be. So I think that's a huge problem, a huge change, which is has made the problem worse, our divisions worse. To the second point of, nuances within the back row, there's certainly a lot of them. There's a lot of nuances within the front row. But I think communities are more defined overall, or in neighborhoods, by kind of being either back row or front row. And so it almost becomes, on a political level or even a philosophical level, there becomes almost a groupthink, a supportive, that if your community is kind of defined as back row because most of the people, are blue collar and have worked in factories, or work at McDonald's, you're going to be treated, your community is going to be stigmatized as being back rows. And I think even the successful members of that community end up rallying to defend the community, rallying to defend those. It's almost like you're supportive of those in your congregation. In terms of this, the really back row, the ones I spend a lot of time with, the homeless addicts and the jobless, is, or I guess an English term, those living rough. Often they are members of somebody's family who lives in the community, or they may be friends of friends or somebody you went to high school with. So although they are often stigmatized within their own community, they're people know, and so there's a more of a connection there than there is when it's just somebody you don't know.
That's great. A lot of that sounds familiar. I was thinking about Charles Murray talks about the division into super zip codes now, that you have to go, oftentimes you have these concentrations of power and wealth that have culturally separated folks from the communities, from other strata of the community in a way that, 50 years ago, it just wasn't the case. And I've seen that even interestingly enough in, the way neighborhoods will fall out, and that plays out in churches. Two, not because the church doesn't allow folks in without credentials, although, it's interesting you brought that up. The gospel, the good news that we talk about all the time is that you can enter the church, you can come to Jesus without credentials. He comes for the uncredentialed. But the irony is that because we still end up living in certain neighborhoods, and neighborhoods have stratified along these lines just sort of naturally because of jobs and movement and so forth, or maybe unnaturally, maybe something you want to speak to. Churches will often mirror their local communities in a lot of those ways, and you still end up having front row churches versus back row churches. I'm curious if you have visited, so the chapter on the church, the way church figured into the stories of folks in these neighborhoods, I'd love to hear you talk more about how that kind of has impacted your own relationship to understanding religion and faith and so far. I know you mentioned a background and a history there, but I'd love to hear that. But I'd also love to hear if you've kind of been to, in a sense, front row churches in the suburbs, so to speak, versus the back row churches in the communities that you were visiting, and if you've seen some of those differences, or if they're there or if they're not, or any comment on that, I'm curious to hear you unpack some of that. So,
yeah. Right, I'll start a little bit with my history, then address the second part, or the part about the differences in the churches. I grew up in a. My father was of Jewish descent, who had escaped. His family escaped Germany in 37 or 38, and he ended up living by a series of coincidences, he ended up living in a small rural southern town that was 98% to 99% Catholic. There aren't many Catholics in the South, but town I grew up in, San Antonio, was founded as a Catholic community in the 1880s, 1860s or so, and so. My father was very very flexible, and so he's like, okay, we're going to raise you as Catholics, since everybody else around you is Catholic, and the church is a block away, and you know, when in Rome, do as the Romans. So I was raised as Catholic, went to Catholic school, which was a block away from me, for the first 6 years of my education. Went through confirmation and communion, and even worked at one of my early jobs as when I was 13 and 14 was working at the local monastery, which was a Benedictine monastery 2 miles away from us, St. Leo, that provided me a job as a youth, basically working in the convent and the monastery. And then I left. I left the church very, very proudly left, because I was, as I got more and more into science and as I read books and thought about the world, I was happy to leave the church. I became an atheist, and I think if you had asked me up till 8 years ago, I would have said I was an atheist. And although I like to think I wasn't one of those atheists who makes fun of religion, I certainly was surrounded by them. This process of going into these neighborhoods and basically learning from listening to people instead of, you know, focusing on reading it in a book has made me, have an entirely different view on faith. I won't call myself religious. I go to church now and then. What I did in these communities was I would, you know, again, if I wanted to learn or understand how people thought, I needed to do what they did, and what they did was go to church. And so I went to churches pretty often. Whenever I was in a place, I would try to go on Wednesday or Friday, Saturday, or Sunday, depending on the faith of the institution. And I try to choose those churches that were most reflective of the neighborhood I was in, and that meant back row churches. And so as somebody who was kind of dabbling with coming back to the Catholic Church, I would attend Catholic Mass here and there, and often it was in front row neighborhoods, and there was a very big difference I saw in the congregation and the way that the church figured and factored in the people's lives versus when I was in basically Pentecostal churches that were, you know, what I loved about the Pentecostal churches was they often, the spaces they occupied were, you know, a former Kentucky Fried Chicken that was turned into a church, or an old furniture store in a strip mall that was down on its luck, who they had taken over. And so I almost ended up always going to services in what I found the kind of the most unique spaces I could find. And it was there that I found kind of the literally no barrier to entry, and a much more emotive process. And it was those churches that I kind of found the most, I certainly had the most impact on me in terms of how they factored it into the lives of people who had otherwise had nothing at all. And it wasn't just, you know, there was a period of when I would tell you, like I think a lot of atheists who end up becoming less angry about faith, they usually just see it in utilitarian sense, like, you know, hey, I may not believe in religion, but other people believe in it and it helps them, so it's got to be good. I mean, there is that phase that I went through, which I think is ultimately still very demeaning. And kind of where I am now is much more at the level of, well, you know, it's maybe my privilege and my way of thinking is not allowing me to see faith, the full truthfulness of faith. Maybe, you know, maybe to put it in kind of my old language is, you know, maybe it's not just useful to the poor. Maybe people who are poor are able to see the evidence that faith is true. So I think that's kind of where I am now, at a level of understanding that it can be, you know, I give it as much truthfulness as anything can be true, you know, and within my worldview.
That's really interesting to hear that. I found it a fascinating book to read because it reminded me of several completely different kinds of book. Which was interesting. I think it'll probably, I don't know if this is true, but I imagine it being put on the sort of J.D. Vance kind of type of book, and even understanding macro America in the context of Trumpism. Well, I can see that that's sort of one of the places it would obviously fit in contemporary political discourse. But it really reminded me of a couple of other what you're saying at the moment. I just touching when it comes to the non-credentialedness, which I find so interesting, and obviously with the theological hat on, but seeing the concept of grace and the understanding of really the poor and the broken and the mission of Jesus to people who are effectively marginal or back row Israel, I suppose. And so I find it interesting through that lens. It seemed to do that even just without even trying to go there, although interestingly towards the end of the book you were much, much sort of clearer on the way in which you'd come to see the connections there, which I thought, so there was a sort of religious grace, non-credentialedness side to it, I felt, as well as the beautiful photography. But it also really reminded me much less of stuff which you're reading today in the wake of, there's plenty of stuff written in the wake of Trump and Brexit and all the rest about communities that are somewhat similar to the ones you're describing. But I read I don't know if you'd read George Orwell's The Road to Wigan Pier or Down and Out in Paris and London or any of his essays about those, because Orwell did a lot of this, is sort of traveling in what you would regard as either very, very, very working class or homeless communities, and did all of those in many ways from a very similar, obviously he wasn't a bond trader, but he was grew up in the empire and felt very, I suppose we would now use the language of felt very privileged and felt like he wanted to really connect with the real world, such as it was, and go out into communities that he would never have experienced from his boarding school privileged background. And I just wondered if you were conscious as you were writing of writing a book like that, or writing a book of a particular, it's an unusual genre of book. As I said, it combines several different kinds of things. And I wondered if you mentally put it on a map along with some of those other kind of books, or another book entirely, and whether or not you'd seen connections like that between what you were doing and what Orwell did. And if you didn't, whether you think that rings true, and if you did, whether it actually shaped your own work in any way.
The Economist compared it to that book, the Wigan Road book, which in their review, The Economist, the British tabloid or weekly magazine, to my surprise, because I intentionally didn't do any reading around this book because I didn't want to, A, out of laziness, B, when you're involved in it, it's just too much to spend your free time reading other stuff. And three, intellectually, I didn't want to come with any biases. So often when I'd go to a town, I wouldn't read anything about the town, and would just come with kind of I didn't want to come kind of with a presumption about a place. And I kind of did the same thing with a book, which is I didn't read around. People would say you should read blank. Your book is going to be like blank, and I didn't read blank, just to keep myself without. Same thing with my photography is I don't. People saying you should look at the work of blank. They did something similar to you, and I'm like, no, I don't want to do that because I don't want to end up basically reacting to them, copying them, or doing anything that would kind of, I just want to do what I feel is natural to the moment. And that's the way I approached the book, was kind of intentionally doing it in a vacuum. So I didn't get swayed in one direction or the other. I just kind of let the people I dealt with sway me to the place I wanted to be. And I understand that that's also very lazy of me, but that is what I did. I think the problem comes in that, we all end up deriving things from other things, and sometimes that's great, but if your kind of stated goal is to kind of rethink the way you think, I think it helps to kind of just do, and to do so from kind of an experiential level, it helps just to kind of just let people, let events guide you, not history.
Well, the doing the reading first is a very front row, do your homework before you go ahead and plunge into it kind of approach to that, isn't it? So kind of entering
into it without that would be...
Right. I mean, the only thing I would do is, and it became, what I would do is I was on Twitter when I was doing all my travels, and sometimes I'd say, hey, I'm going to Michigan, any suggestions? And I would go to the place that nobody suggested. If a lot of people suggested it as nice as they are, I knew that there was probably probably more going on there in a positive. It was almost always a place that had a university, for one, you know. And so I ended up using people's. That's the only way I used research, was kind of as a negative indicator. If you all told me go to Ann Arbor, I wasn't going to go to Ann Arbor, you know, because that tells me that I know exactly what I'm going to find in Ann Arbor. I'm going to find a lot of front row institutions and, you know, and wonderful bespoke culinary institutes and things like that, which is all well and good, but that's not what I was exploring.
Your book is titled Dignity, and that particular word, I found it a very powerful way of framing the exploration that you did, that dignity is in focusing upon dignity, and also in the way that you took your photos, the way that you described gave people their own voice, that concern for the way that people craft their own sense of meaning in the world in response to all these obstacles in our current society for them to find a sense of agency and meaning and purpose. How did that focus upon meaning, dignity, and other things like that reframe your consideration of the issues more generally, which are so often considered merely in terms of material deprivation, in quantitative terms that you described at the beginning? How does that quest for meaning in those most difficult of circumstances, how can that speak to our situations where in more advantaged positions, we may not have considered meaning as we ought to?
I think, I guess it's just never really been in my DNA to make fun of people. So even when I was an atheist, I wouldn't make fun of the religious. And so when I walk into a community, it's really just not who I am to kind of take pictures that make people look awkward or ugly or destitute. One of the things that, you know, I tried to do in the pictures, if I did have a stated goal, you asked me about what my stated goal was, to basically, I used to say, take conventional pictures of unconventional people, which is we in the front row all really we work very hard to control our image and the image people see of us, down to like our headshots. We get professional photographs taken of us that glamorize us and present us in the way we want to be presented. And so rarely is that afforded to the back row. They often, their pictures are often taken in situations where they don't have much control over the process. And so in my photographs, what I try to do was allow the person being taken, who have their picture taken, to have control over that process, meaning it would come after, the photograph would only come after a long period of talking. It would only come with their consent, full consent. It would only come, often I let them choose how they wanted to be photographed. Often that meant they would go into the bathroom in the McDonald's and clean up, fix their hair, put on some makeup. I think that in that sense, it's not journalism, which is why I don't generally call myself a journalist, because a lot of journalists would say that's not presenting reality, but I think it's a fair way to present it. I think it's the ethical way to do it, honestly. It's the moral way to do it, which is to provide people, you know, the dignity to be photographed they want to be photographed. Right. You know, what struck me when I first went into the South Bronx with this place that I was told to be an awful place was how awful the obstacles people faced were, but yet how resilient they were in response to that. You know, one of the things that brought me to the neighborhood, besides the stigma, was there's some of the pictures in the book of it, but pigeon keepers, I don't know if they have that in the UK to the degree they have it here, is a lot of poor people, especially Hispanics in New York City, keep pigeons on their roof. They curate them, so to speak. They build these coops, and they have flocks of often up to 500 to 600 pigeons that they fly, twice a week, twice a day. They release them and they fly them, and they direct their flights with poles, with flags on poles. And there's really nothing to it. Some people call it a sport, but it's not really a sport. It's just a thing. They go up on their roofs. They find abandoned buildings, maybe break in and climb to the roof, put a ladder in, climb to the roof, and build these coops where they keep pigeons. And that for me was always this really wonderful example of trying to find, you know, make art. I consider it an artistic endeavor, make art out of something that's generally stigmatized. You know, most people consider pigeons to be rats with wings. But when you go up on the rooftops and you see these gorgeous flights of pigeons, you realize how beautiful it is and why they're doing it. Again, it's bringing dignity to their life. It's bringing beauty to their life. And similarly, there was another hobby that I loved where people take bicycles, discarded bikes that the wealthy throw away or have moved beyond, the Schwinn bicycles. They were kind of the lower class bikes of everybody in the 50s and 60s. And they turned them into these extravagant show vehicles that they ride around town, and they form clubs to do it. And I think that's another example of kind of making the best of what you've been given and adding dignity to your life and beauty to your life. And I think that's kind of what I saw, you know, what struck me was how people can make the best out of a bad situation. And that means in a larger sense, at a more deeper level, trying to find meaning in a world that hasn't given them many options to have meaning. You know, again, the front row has this very, in my mind, this very narrow definition of allowable forms of meaning, which is entirely economic. And by definition, the back row doesn't have economic meaning. All they have is non-credentialed forms of meaning. And those forms of meaning, race, faith, place, have been devalued by the front. You know, the quest for dignity, when your form of meaning has been devalued, that's humiliating. And often you look for respect and, you know, or dignity. Now, the quest for dignity, the desire to have dignity, the desire to have respect doesn't always play out in positive ways. There's some very, very ugly forms of seeking respect. And those are the ones I worry about. You know, if we devalue the ones that are harmless, people are going to find other ones like drugs and racism to give them a sense of meaning.
Yeah, that was, I think, one of the most just insightful points of the whole analysis, is just seeing the way folks are constructing good and bad dignity and meaning in positives like place, and even the way that those positive ways of construing it, meaning connected to fairly positive things like place, in the modern economy can end up penalizing them, can end up dragging them back into kind of dependency relationships or into that place where, seeking face, through things like, you know, racial identification, and, you know, white supremacy or things like that. It was probably one of the most, insightful and useful bits of analysis that I saw in there. One last question, just to wrap up, if you have the time. If there was one sort of thing that you hope folks are taking away from the book as they move forward in thinking about, I don't know, relating to their neighbors or thinking about the political scene in the U.S. or anything like that, your hopes for folks reading this book, the big, you know, your big takeaway, I suppose.
There are two, and I'm going to cheat and give you two. One is, because as somebody mentioned on this conversation, unfortunately, most of the people who are going to read this book is the front row. And I guess that's good. I don't know how to create a book that is, you know, how to create something like this that is read by the back row. I hope it's read by the back row, but I doubt it will be to the extent I wish it was. So I guess I'll talk to the front row, and that being, because that's the audience for the book, that's just a reality. One is, you know, you have a lot more privilege than you realize you have. We talk about privilege so much. If you have an advanced education, you have a lot more privilege than you realize, and no matter how well-intended you are, how you think is very narrow in terms of the definition of meaning. You know, you generally see only one access, one allowable access of meaning, and that could be a problem. And it's I'm not saying the back row isn't responsible, equally responsible for the problems that we have in this country. They also are very closed-minded. But, you know, in the front row, because of our position, we have a lot more, in my mind, we have a lot more responsibility to think about the consequences of our actions, because they do have a larger consequences. The other, which is a broader thing, is a very, very simple message, which is simply, you know, before you judge somebody, walk a mile in their shoes. You know, you don't even have to walk a mile in their shoes. Just sit down with them in a McDonald's and have a coffee. You know, context is everything. I mean, I'm a leftist, and I think I'm a classic leftist in the sense that when I look at people's decisions, especially any group's decisions in aggregate, I blame the political structures that they find themselves in, not anything atavistic, not, you know, a personal weakness, not intelligence, not how hardworking they are. You got to look at political structures that surround people's decisions. And at the individual level, that means, you know, again, find out the full story before you pass judgment on somebody. And often when you find out that full story, you're going to have a lot more understanding of why that person might have made that decision.
Yeah, that's fallibility has layers. We're not fallible. We're not weak in just a vacuum. That's great. Thank you so much for coming on, Chris. This was a great conversation. Great book, really eye opening, and so many things that we didn't get to. So if you've been listening with us and you've made it this far, once again, the book is Dignity: Seeking Respect in Back Row America. I'm sure it's, you know, wherever books are sold, but obviously Amazon and so forth. Very worth picking up. Chris, thanks for your time. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. It was a very enjoyable conversation.
That's wonderful. And again, for our listeners, this has been Mere Fidelity. Thank you for listening to us. If you enjoyed the show or you enjoy the show in general, go ahead and maybe swing by iTunes, rate and review us. You can listen on SoundCloud or check out, we'll have links in the show notes at mereorthodoxy.com. Also, a special thank you to our Patreon subscribers. You can check us out at Patreon, and that link is also in the show notes at mereorthodoxy.com. But for now, this has been Mere Fidelity. Thank you for listening.